I'd like now to welcome back Allegra Love. She is an immigration attorney. She was on the Radio Cafe a few weeks ago talking about the situation for Central American refugees. Welcome back, Allegra, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me back.
So you have recently been in Artesia, New Mexico, where there is a detention center where a lot of the people who have crossed the border fleeing horrifying conditions that you've described in Central America, particularly Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. You went there. What's going on there?
So the facilities in Artesia, New Mexico, which is really, really quite remote, it's about 250 miles from Santa Fe and 200 miles from El Paso. So it's in the middle of the desert. And it's a detention facility for women and children who have recently arrived on the border. They're in a process called expedited removal, which is for people who are within a couple days of arriving and very, very close to the border, who are apprehended in that way. It's a process for arriving aliens. And it's women and children. There's about 700 people there. And the average age of the child is 6 years old there. And I went down because many, if not all, of the women and children who are being detained there have a legitimate claim to open an asylum case due to the fact that they're fleeing extreme violence and death threats in their own countries. And so they need lawyers on the ground to help them assert that asylum claim and also to help them get bond. Because if they don't get out on bond, they have to make their asylum case very, very, very quickly from within detention. But if they get out on bond, they have the time and the resources to prepare a good asylum claim and hopefully stay in the United States, to prepare a fair asylum claim and have a fair hearing.
Now, one of the things that I've heard is that the bonds are set very, very high, impossibly high.
Right. When the facility opened about 6 or 7 weeks ago, the Department of Homeland Security chief, Jay Johnson, made a public statement saying that they would deport every single person in the facility. As a lawyer, I know that that's not okay because many of them have a legitimate claim to stay in the United States because they're fleeing violence. They're refugees. So the government has made their priority clear and their policy clear because they want to deter more Central Americans from fleeing to the United States. We have a big problem with immigrants in this country, and they want to send the message, don't come. But once someone asserts an asylum claim and gets through the first interview, which is the credible fear interview, they have the right to stay. The only thing that the judges have control of at that point is the bond. And the bond determines if they're going to be released. And if they're released, they have years to prepare their asylum case. If they're not released, they have days, 20 days, 40 days, a small amount of time. And so I think the idea is set the bond at $30,000. No one has that kind of, especially a migrant family, no one has that kind of money to spring someone from the facility. And what they're left with is a month to prepare an extraordinarily complicated case that'll likely be denied by the judge and will result in their deportation. The average bond for refugees is in the low thousands. They can set it at zero. They can release them on their own recognizance. It's all at the discretion of the judge. And there are even women who entered the country with their men, their husbands or partners. The partners were released within a few days, which is normal for a refugee or an asylee. And they've been in there 2 months because they're making an example out of the women and children in Artesia.
An example of what?
That you can't come to this country, that we will not help you.
But the men can come?
Apparently. It's hard to know exactly what's happening with the men. This summer, the media has been really, really focused on the unaccompanied child, the 50,000, the one we all heard about in July, the arriving children who are alone. But the sort of interesting thing is they are the kids who have the most legal protection, and they're given over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement really quickly, and they are not allowed to be deported without a fair hearing. While we were focused as a country with our media on that small group of kids, arriving adult aliens and children who were arriving with family members were being put through this rapid process of expedited removal. And as it turns out, They've already found out that 10 children we deported this year back to Honduras have been murdered.
And those 10 are very likely the tip of the iceberg.
Probably.
I mean, those are the ones we know about.
Yeah.
Many, many more have been deported.
And I talked with these women down in Artesia, and they are running from real, real life threats, domestic violence, gang violence, extraordinarily brutal sexual violence.
You talked to people in Artesia and actually got some of their stories. Tell us some of those.
One woman I talked to is from Guatemala. She's actually from a Mayan community, and she doesn't speak Spanish. And she was with four of her children. No, excuse me, she was with three of her children. She had a fourth living in the United States. And she had been using her 10-year-old son as a Spanish interpreter for the 6 weeks they had been in the facility. And we finally got a Maya Conjoval interpreter on an iPhone. So it was this kind of crazy situation where the interpreter spoke Conjoval and Spanish. I speak Spanish and English. So we're sort of doing a three-way interpretation. Right. And the moment her son was able to step away from the interpreter's table for the first time, she was able to communicate with someone not through her 10-year-old son. She revealed that she'd been gang raped, and that was why they fled Guatemala. And this woman is hysterical because she's been holding this for weeks and weeks and weeks in her migration too. She had been gang raped because someone had threatened to harm her children unless she accepted the rape. And so the moment she gets him away, she's hysterical and lets us know she's been raped. And she has a bond hearing the next day. She hasn't had, no one has known that she had an asylum claim. That's absolutely an asylum claim. And she, literally 12 hours before her bond hearing, was able to finally communicate with an attorney that she was too scared to return to Guatemala. Another thing is the kids are suffering in ways that you can't imagine kids could be suffering under a government's care. They're children, and they're incarcerated, and that pretty much, when you start with that, you're going to be immediately into human rights abuses because kids should not be incarcerated.
First, when you said the kids are suffering under government care, I thought you meant in Guatemala or Honduras. You're talking about in Artesia.
I'm talking about
in
Artesia. And so you're sitting with moms who are saying things like, my 10-year-old daughter was 75 pounds when she entered this facility, and now she's 58 pounds. That's 20% of her body weight.
They're not feeding the children?
They're feeding them, and some of the kids are eating, but some of the kids are not. They're traumatized. They're terrorized. They're being abused and humiliated. They're incarcerated.
They're being abused and humiliated by the guards?
By the guards. They have no idea what's happening to them. They have no idea where they are. You can't incarcerate children. They're sick. Why? Because there's no such thing as a prison pediatrician, right? The doctors there or whoever they are, the medics, the nurses, are all under prison contracts. They come from a correctional organization that gives medical care to people in correctional facilities. They're not trained in pediatrics because you don't incarcerate children.
Right.
And so the kids are very sick, they're scared, they're listless and lifeless, and this is all happening in a situation where an immigration judge with discretion could release every single one of them on their own recognizance or a low bond.
Right.
But anyway, so this mom, whose kid has already lost something like 16 pounds, is telling me one of the problems is that the breakfast is served at 5 a.m. And kids don't want to eat at 5 a.m. And they especially don't want to eat foods they're not comfortable with, foods they've never tried before. They're used to a certain diet. So the mom told me she tried to put a piece of bread in her pocket so when the kid was ready to eat at 7 or 8, or when the kid said they were hungry, she could give her the bread. And the guards threw the bread away rather than let the mom take the bread and feed her kid later. They would rather throw food away than find a way to get the food into the kids' tummies when the kid's ready for it. You can't force a kid to eat.
This is here in the United States of America. This is
It's 200 miles from Santa Fe.
Yeah.
It feels like more like an internment camp because when there's children detained and incarcerated, it doesn't even feel like a jail. It feels like an internment camp or a concentration camp more than it does. It's like a cognitive dissonance to see children in that situation. They wouldn't even let them have crayons.
Yeah, there was somebody brought them crayons and the guard went ballistic.
Ballistic.
Did you witness this?
I came in the aftermath of that, and I witnessed a guard go ballistic when someone tried to give a kid a marker to use a coloring book. Because he'd lost the crayon battle, and then he said, you know, there were no crayons available, and someone tried to give him a marker, and...
What did he do?
He took the markers away. They took the chairs away so women couldn't wait in chairs.
They're sitting on the floor.
The kids are all sitting on the floor. There had been like a chairs lined up so people could wait, and now they have to sit with the attorney at the table. They're not allowed to wait in a chair. The kids are lying on the floor, and it's horrible. It's hard to articulate.
And the only people who are witnessing this are essentially the attorneys right now.
The attorneys, and there's some legal assistants. Some attorneys brought legal assistants.
Yeah.
There are about a dozen people on the ground in the team I was working with. On Thursday, the last day I was there, there were four attorneys on the ground and 417 women on the caseload, which is a lot to put on the shoulders of a few attorneys.
Yeah.
It's complete triage there. People are getting prepared for hearings 10 minutes before the hearings. We were in the center 10, 12 hours, and then going back to a church had built like a makeshift sort of headquarters, going back to the headquarters and working till 1 in the morning writing motions, getting a few hours of sleep, heading back into the center. And I was there 4 days, and it felt like it was like dog years. And there are attorneys who have been there for weeks.
Have you been able to have any success with the cases that you've taken on?
No. I was just sort of carrying a case forward a little bit. An attorney had started it. Another attorney had picked it up. I picked it up somewhere in the middle and pushed the cases forward a little bit, prepared motions, prepared clients for hearings. I did a couple light hearings myself. They're all, most of the stuff down there, because they all started with credible fear interviews, and now a lot of the women are in the bond stage where they're arguing for bonds. And they have, I mean, I'm JV, maybe even what's below JV, the C team, and there are a few extraordinarily brilliant and experienced lawyers down there, and they are losing these hearings. They're losing these bond arguments, and they are not used to this. And they just, it may as well be me going in and arguing them, because the judge has already made up their mind about it, and the women don't have a chance.
So if they get out, they have a couple of years to prepare an asylum hearing. If they don't get out, they're in these horrible conditions that you're talking about, and they've got a couple of weeks to prepare. What do you need to bring to an asylum hearing?
Well, you need to bring evidence of your threat. You need to bring expert witnesses, expert affidavits. Asylum cases are very, very, very hard to win. It's probably not even worth on the radio going into the details of what you need to win an asylum case. It involves having your case having a nexus to an identifiable group that you're a part of. I'm going to try and make this as simple as possible. Just because you come from a violent place doesn't mean that you're being persecuted as a refugee or an asylee, the way our law looks at it. You have to say, I'm a Christian, I'm gay, I'm part of a union, I'm part of a tribal group that's traditionally persecuted. You have to have a connection to a sort of recognizable group.
Is battered women?
Well, that's changed last week. The problem that a lot of Central American asylees are facing is they're facing generalized violence from gangs. And they can't find a way to connect the violence to a group that they're in. Last week, the Bureau of Immigration Appeals, or the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is essentially like the Supreme Court of immigration law, came out with a decision saying that Guatemalan women fleeing domestic abuse are a recognizable social group for asylum law and for the refugee definition, which is really important because so many of the women who are currently locked up in Artesia are fleeing partner violence, extreme partner violence.
Now, I think it's worth saying that this ruling only applies to Guatemalans. It doesn't apply to Honduras.
Well, yeah, but any lawyer worth their salt is going to be able to argue that country conditions are similar, and they're going to use that ruling to push decisions in other countries.
Right.
It's a good decision for any woman from Central America.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you've met people, all kinds of people, women. I mean, you wrote a piece about a woman who had fled Guatemala, whose husband was wealthy and well-connected,
mm-hmm.
who beat the living heck out of her,
mm-hmm.
and who and the police didn't do anything, finally escaped with her children. And she, in theory, has a case. But in practice, if she's not given bond...
I mean, she has no way to communicate with anyone on the outside. So if she's not given bond... If she's given bond, she's going to be released to, I think, a friend in Houston or Indianapolis, somewhere. She has a friend who has basically attested to the fact that she's going to help her and be responsible for her in pursuing her asylum case. And... I think that the asylum docket's really backed up right now, and it's probably going to be 2 years before she actually gets her hearing. 2 years is a great amount of time to develop an asylum case, to find a lawyer, to raise the money to pay for the case, to gather all the information, to make sure your lawyer does an excellent job, to make sure that you are actually getting a fair hearing and a fair examination of whether your life is in danger. I mean, the real issue is, if you have 3 weeks detained inside a facility in the desert of New Mexico to prepare an asylum case and the government gets it wrong, you could get murdered when you arrive home. And that's the real horror of all this. For political reasons, we've turned this place into a deportation mill. And these women, the reality is, could get murdered. And many of them will get murdered. And... because we need to process them through quickly and make a point about unlawful immigration in this country, we are going to see women and children murdered.
We're talking to immigration attorney Allegra Love. Now, it's sort of unimaginable, I think, for most of us who have some kind of mythology about the United States of America being a place that is, if not welcoming, at least fair and certain basic ways, and still, even for those of us who are kind of over that mythology, we haven't seen what you have seen firsthand, Allegra. I mean, it must be a lot to deal with.
Yeah. How do I put this? I work with very vulnerable families in Santa Fe who have experienced a lot of violence and have some of them have very scary lives. Three times, and I thought I was prepared to deal with women in trauma and seeing what I was going to see in Artesia. Three times during consultation, the few days I was down there, I had to excuse myself, and I was like, I'm sorry, I have to print something. And I said something like that, and had to walk behind a barrier and put my head between my legs because I thought I was going to throw up. I don't know if I can explain how horrible it is to see children suffering and to theoretically have the power to relieve them and to help them and be shut down and not be able to do it. I can't imagine how their mothers must feel. They've endured so much already on the front end of this journey, the reasons for their flight. And to arrive here and be forced to be locked up and watch their children deteriorate and suffer, it's probably the worst thing you can do to a woman. People need to let go of the idea that the rule of law is... how do I say this? The rule of law is, I guess, what's controlling things down there, but it's not working. If this is what the rule of law does to people, then we've got to change our laws.
Well, it seems like, as you said, there is quite a bit of discretion. I mean, if it's an asylum case... the rule of law doesn't say that you have to have a $30,000 bond.
It doesn't say anything. It's up to the discretion of the immigration judges.
Yeah.
And these judges should be ashamed of themselves. They're in Arlington, Virginia.
They're not even in
New Mexico. It's all it's not telephonic, it's video conferencing.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting at a table about this big, like a little card table, with the client on one side sitting next to me. And if they have children, the children sitting on her lap. And you're looking at a flat screen TV at a judge who's 2,000 miles away.
So that judge doesn't even have the kind of visceral experience of seeing what's going on in Artesia.
No, they haven't been there. The Department of Homeland Security, we were supposed to have a meeting with them. They ended up calling in. They didn't even want to come look at us face to face.
What kind of national attention is this story getting, if any?
The New York Times... Well, okay, so the ACLU did a lawsuit about 2 weeks ago asking for an injunction against what's happening down there. I don't know how the Justice Department is handling that right now. There certainly seemed to be a lot of suits around when I was there, quote-unquote, investigating.
Men in suits kind of thing?
Yeah. In entourages of people who are high up in the government, walking around with the director of the facility, peeking in on things. The New York Times did a pretty good editorial about it. PBS did a really interesting video with one of the lead lawyers down there. You know, some blogs have picked it up. But it's not getting a lot of national attention. And I think it ought to. We've had a tough summer, though, and there's a lot happening in the news, and there might be some fatigue with American citizens about just how much suffering we have going on in our country and abroad right now.
Yeah, times are not good right now.
Yeah.
In general. What can our listeners do to help?
The most important thing right now is sharing knowledge about this and making sure you are educating yourself about what's going on there. And this is why, for anyone who's still following everything that I'm talking about asylum law, congratulations. It's an extraordinarily complicated area of law, and it's hard to understand. The opposite argument, the racist one, is very easy to understand. They say, these women are criminals, they broke the law. Sorry, it sucks, we're sad they're suffering, but they need to go home. So when you're looking at how to think about something and one argument is very simple to understand, and then the other argument involves complicated issues of asylees and violence and this geopolitical nightmare that's the gang violence in Central America, that's harder to understand. So sometimes it's easier to just accept a simple explanation of what's happening. And so we have to work against accepting simple explanations of why people are suffering. And then we need donations for lawyers, for legal counsel and legal assistance. I just went down there. My work, Adelante, helped me with a crowdfunding website, and we were able to raise, I think it's up to like $6,000 right now, but I was able to bring $500 worth of copy paper down. I was able to pay all the internet hotspots, because there's no internet in there, and so we were able to bring hotspots in, which is those data bills go through the roof immediately, especially when you have a couple attorneys working all day long using them. I was able to buy meals for all the lawyers. They're saying that on the high end, a lawyer being there a week could cost that lawyer $2,000. Not to mention the fact that these people have jobs. This isn't their job to be here. It's no one's job. These are all volunteer attorneys. So they're saying to have a lawyer there is about $2,000 a week. And that's very, very costly. So really, contributing to funds that are going to get lawyers on the ground there is the best way to make sure that this fight continues and that these women are given every opportunity to ask for their safety here and avoid being deported.
What are the sites that people can go to? I mean, I will link to them on my website, santaferadiocafe.org, but tell us what they
are. So if you're interested in donating locally to our site that we're doing at Adelante, there's a website. It's through a crowdfunding source called YouCaring, and the link will be on Mary Charlotte's website. Just yesterday, the American Immigration Council opened up a fund as well that's going to collect funds and then donate funds to different AILA chapters. And the AILA is American Immigration Lawyers Association. That's what I'm a part of. And so they're going to give money to different AILA chapters all over the country so that they can afford to send lawyers down there. Access to counsel is the most critical thing in this situation. Everything else is pretty much helpless. There's nothing we can do to control it. But the one sliver of control that the average person has is getting counsel into there. And it's absolutely critical. And it's the only fair thing for these women, that they have a fair adjudication of whether or not they're going to be killed if they're sent home.
Is there any way to pressure the judges or the people running these detention centers?
I don't know. If Americans became fired up enough about it and pressured the Obama administration to do something, yeah. But
that hasn't happened
that
yet.
That hasn't happened yet. Yeah. And,
you know, I think ultimately it's like so many of the things that are going on in the news and in the world right now. Just put yourself in their shoes. Just take 5 minutes and put yourself in the shoes of a woman who is in this position, and then think about whether you can still make the argument she's breaking the law.
I mean, and Mary Charlotte, a lot of these women haven't broken a single law. There's nothing illegal about arriving to a country to ask for refuge. And they're not criminals. And any judge will be first to admit it. They're in a process of expedited removal and a process of asking for asylum, which allows them to be detained. And the law allows them to be detained in that process. But a lot of them have not broken a single law. And they're being treated like animals, and they're being treated like criminals. And I cannot emphasize how regular these women are. They've been through a lot and they've been traumatized, but they're regular people. They could be, think of your sister, think of your mother, think of your kids, think of your nieces and nephews, the kids you know, the women you know. They are these women. And think about a young child who you care about being locked up and not being able to eat, who's never done anything. And that's what you're dealing with down there. And that's why someone like me, who's had exposure to all sorts of violence, almost vomits during a consultation, because you can't incarcerate children. You can't do it. There's no humane way to incarcerate a child. It doesn't exist. It's called a concentration camp when you incarcerate a child.
You said a few minutes ago that the argument against these people that was easy to understand, in other words, they've crossed the border illegally, even though that's not even really exactly accurate, but you know, the argument is they crossed the border illegally and send them home, period. You said that's the racist argument. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, I'm not sure I've ever had a debate with someone about immigration issues where their argument isn't somewhere associated with racist opinions about Latino people. And a lot of times that person's not a racist, but they have listened to racist arguments about it and accepted racist arguments about it. And they're so hidden, the racism is so hidden in economics, social policy, all of that, that this person who's not even, that would never be described as a racist, is buying and repeating these arguments that are very much found in racist. People want to argue with me about immigration all the time. They don't like that my job is to help people stay in the country who they consider criminals. They don't like it. And they want to argue with me all the time about it. And I'm happy to have an argument with someone if they can present me an argument that isn't about racism or isn't fundamentally rooted in racist opinions about Latinos. Haven't had that argument yet, though. And we're all, you know, you can't argue with someone about racism. You won't get anywhere. It's a waste of breath. And that's why I don't want to argue with anyone about this. Children, women and children are suffering, full stop. The policy arguments can come later. Relieving that suffering is our job, first and foremost. And then giving them a fair shot to prove that their lives are in danger. We have to do that first, and then we can argue about the policy of them being in our country.
It's almost like the kind of objectification of these people, like seeing them as less than human, is a necessary part of the incarceration.
Yes, absolutely. Because if you could look at a woman and a child locked up, a woman, let's say, who's been sexually assaulted multiple times, who fled her country across a continent, essentially. And if you could look at her and realize that that person could be your sister or your wife or your daughter, and if you felt it on that level, you would feel like I feel right now.
Yeah.
And you would feel like you can't go on, and you would feel really, really afraid. And that's just, it's hard to live like that.
Allegra Love is an immigration attorney. She worked with the Adelante program in the Santa Fe Public Schools. And once again, we're going to link to the You Caring site and to the various...
The American Immigration Council.
American Immigration yeah. Council on SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Allegra, on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.